was at the Healthy People. Is that easier? I don't have to talk as loud. I was at the Healthy People 2020 meeting here at APHA. Anybody saw that Monday morning? They had a little public forum, and at that meeting, they talked about the challenges of collecting data for small populations, rare populations, and the challenges of collecting data for some of the populations as well that do not speak English as a native language, different things like that, with the large surveillance instruments. And the people running Healthy People 2020 understand that this is something that the big surveys are not very good at. But unfortunately, what's very unnerving for me, and I'm sure other people who represent disparity populations, is that they don't have a lot of answers yet on how to do a better job of getting good data for these populations. And as a result, in Healthy People 2020, which is the premier federal health policy planning document, sets the goals that then create the policy priorities, which then create the funding priorities, which then put the money on the street, right? The LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities are at risk of being eliminated of the next iteration of that document. Because unfortunately, the question is not being asked on many of the surveillance instruments that they use as the ones that they will respect and include. So we have health disparities. We see that from enough smaller and some large-scale surveillance instruments, and we'll talk about the tobacco ones in just a second. But the question is not being put into many surveillance instruments, so we do not have as much of the evidence on what these health disparities are, and as a result, we're at risk of being eliminated from the federal policy planning and state policy planning as well. So I just want to say that because this is, before I kind of talk about this briefing paper here, this is a catch-22 situation that is rather distressing. And that's why the issue of not just LGBT tobacco surveillance, but how to collect data on a rare population, on a small population, but how to do it well is very much a concern for the LGBT health advocates around the country. You want to visit our meetings, you'll hear us talking about it. We all start to turn into crazy data walks. So it's a big issue that crosses much farther than tobacco. And I actually didn't even ask, how long do we have for this presentation? I knew it had to be close. Okay, great. So what we're going to do here is, you see, as I said, there are significant health disparities, and in tobacco use, there are actually probably some of the most striking health disparities. And I work a lot with the National LGBT Tobacco Network with state programs who are interested in trying to enhance their disparity work to include LGBTs. But as we commonly get, Indiana says, so what are the disparities in Indiana? And I can say to them, I have no idea related to LGBTs because you're not asking the question on any of your standard surveillance instruments. How about if I tell you about California? And I'll be telling you about California a little bit here, but I'll tell you that people in Indiana do not care about California very much. So that's why it's one of the things where we really need to expand the number of places and the ways that we get quality data so I can stop talking about California. Nothing against it for all the Californians on the panel here. It just, you know, there's more states than that in the country. So if the questions don't ask, then we're in the catch-22. And yet, we need the data, and Indiana needs data for Indiana in order to not just address quantify the health disparity in the first place, but obviously to monitor their interventions to see whether it's doing anything to eliminate this disparity. So now just to kind of quickly review some of the different available data that we have from around the country. We see from 2001, a literature review came out from Office of Smoking Health showing that LGBT populations were smoking, and from the biggest studies in that, consistently 40 to 60% more than the general population. And then we had another something come out from California Health Interview Survey, a large full probability study of the state of California showing that gay men smoked 55% more than the general population and lesbians 70% higher. Then we had another large full probability good quality study. The information got worse, again about California. Men smoked at rates 50% higher, and now the LGBT women were almost 200% higher than the general population. From that same study, this is the first data that we start to have available on LGBT of color, and I will tell you the confidence interval is huge, the samples are very, very small, but I still don't want to keep the data a secret because we need to have some hint of what might be happening, no other reason than to say we need to do more work to capture data on these dually impacted populations. So from that study, Hispanic lesbians and gays were smoking 150% more than mainstream population Hispanics, African Americans, and they did not capture bisexual and transgender, or they did not report it. were smoking 110% more, and then of course you see under Asians 330% more. So I'll tell you this, these numbers will change as we get better data, but at least it's important maybe to say these numbers to encourage us to start to figure out why we need to collect the data. Okay, so we know that over a series of studies, and these are large studies, small studies, community-based, pride surveys, full probability samples of whole states, some of them are information that comes off of full probability samples of the whole country. The information stays consistent in all those different types of modes from the data collection. The LGBT communities are smoking between 40 to 200% higher than the general population. And this, you know, unfortunately makes us one of the populations with the most striking health disparity related to tobacco. So people don't usually put the question on, actually I'm not sure why, but I would presume, the assumption is, that first of all, it hasn't been asked before, it's hard to change surveys, but second of all, there's a lot of concerns that we hear expressed that you cannot put the question on because it will unnerve your participants. And what we're finding out is that a lot of those concerns are actually do not have as much foundation as people think, and we're getting a lot of evidence that there's feasibility on putting this question on in a demographic capacity, so that is something that does not require special handling. And I want to point, there's a lot of evidence around a lot of different surveys that this is very feasible. So look at the second part there, which says, if you ask about a person's sexual behavior, that's clearly a sensitive question. If you ask me what I do with my partner, that's a sensitive question. But what we're talking about in this case is when you ask their identity. When you ask their identity, that is not actually proving to be a sensitive question whatsoever. Thus, it can be included in the demographic part of surveys and data collection instruments without any special handling. Usually, as we often say, straight people, for the people who have done the testing on these things, straight people are usually very happy to declare that they're straight in the surveys. And then the LGBTs who are asked the question are often very happy not to be made invisible. So right now, there's an increasing number. I feel as if almost we're reaching the watershed point where pretty soon, if you're not asking these questions on your state surveillance instruments, on federal instruments, or on instruments for your CBO, community-based organization, that you're going to be left behind. And I love that watershed point. We're getting closer to it. At least 8 states ask an LGB question. Many states leave off transgender. And we'll talk about how not to do that because it's foolish. You don't need to. They ask it on their leading state surveillance system, CDC's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, as Virginia taught me to say, BARFIS for short. And then at least 13 states ask it on their youth surveys. They usually do, for people who know these surveys, on the high school version of it. They don't ask it in junior high. And 15 state tobacco quit lines ask when you call the quit line with your LGB or LGBT. An increasing number of federal surveys are also including these questions, including NHANES, National Survey of Family Growth, National Epidemiologic Survey on Alcohol and Related Conditions, and the other ones you see there. I hate when people read PowerPoint slides, so I apologize for that one. Okay, so the first myth that people really have around asking this question in surveys is that people will interrupt the survey, what's called break-off, and so you will not be able to get the data you needed. And so you see here, National Epidemiologic Survey on Alcohol and Related Conditions asked the question in 30,000 interviews and had 0 break-offs. So 30,000 times people were asked, not one person stopped. And then Nurses Health Study 2, 0 people broke off in 91,000 times that they asked the question. It's also important there, you see the refusal rate, the number of people who refuse to do it, and what we find is that people also think that there will be a high refusal rate. And we see here again, through some information from the Massachusetts BARFIS and the information coming from the quit lines, that actually people don't refuse it as often as you would think whatsoever. They're much more likely to refuse an income question. And there was one site I'm still trying to track down from one of the larger studies showing they were more likely to refuse the race question. So I'll leave that out there as a hearsay point. But the issue is they're not likely to refuse this. You know what I will say, and I should actually add another slide here, is what they do is if you ask 1 million people this question or some large number, one person, you should be ready that one person will complain. And they can complain up the chain of command. So what you should do as a policymaker is make sure that the people who are the decision makers are educated about why it is important to ask this question. Because I can, as I said in the last session, I can tell you two states that had these questions yanked off of every one of the surveillance instruments because one person complained. So obviously you have to understand why you have a compelling reason to address this health disparity and why there's justification to have it on. Educate your policymakers so when they get that one complaint, they just don't react with a blanket decision. So as a result, we don't have evidence to help address health disparities for large populations in those two states. Oh, I'm sorry, and that wasn't this slide. This slide is the National LGBT Tobacco Control Network. Our recommendation, supported by so many of our members, is that you do ask LGBT identity questions on the following instruments: the Adult Tobacco Survey, the Behavioral Risk Factor Social Survey, and the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, high school level, and also at Quitline Intake. We went through a process for people who might have been in the last session of cognitively testing some questions for Minnesota, and so I interviewed many, many smokers in Minnesota. I now know more LGBT smokers in Minnesota than I know anybody else right now. And it's interesting being in those cognitive testing is a type of testing for survey questions that is kind of like the gold standard. You ask people a lot about what their perception was of the question they were asked. And it was really interesting being in those because we really did find out that the question is immensely sensitive to tiny changes in wording. I had a fair number of people declare to me that they were absolutely not heterosexual. Whatever happens, they knew they were not heterosexual. And I suspect what they intended to say was they were not homosexual. And so you can see how small changes in the way the question's put together create bigger issues regarding the measurement error. And just from a survey wonk standpoint, whenever you're trying to measure a tiny population, if you do a little bit of confusing the big population, you've ruined the data for the tiny population. So you've got to make sure that the big population really understands when they're being spoken to and when they're not being spoken to. So the lesson here is definitely use a question that has been tested. And we luckily have a growing number of questions now that have been tested to put on instruments. The first one here was tested by... this one is the recent one that came out of the Minnesota testing. And the great thing about this question is that prior to this, the only tested question had been LGB and it excluded transgender, or tried to put transgender on a separate question by itself, which causes some real problems because people don't understand the word. When New York State asked it on their adult tobacco survey, they found out, they said, are you transgender, basically, roughly this. And they found out there were more transgender people in New York State than there were lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and probably a few other categories too, just because that big population got confused. So this is a great new option we have now because it combines the two phenomena into one question, and it has 100% success rate in the cognitive testing of making sure people don't get confused. So even, you see at the bottom there, D, transgender, even if you have no idea what that word means, and even if the survey respondent has no idea what it means, what we see is that putting the lesbian, gay, or bisexual first is kind of like a firewall. They understand you're not talking to them anymore, and they don't suddenly accidentally pick transgender by accident, even though they don't know what it is. So that's a really powerful thing in survey world because you can't confuse that big group of people. And this particular question was tested to go on both a surveillance instrument and a quit line. In a quit line, there is very little demographic questions being asked, very few demographic questions. So people are much more curious as to why you're asking those questions. As a result, many quit lines have a little paragraph like this. And we were given a paragraph to test, and it didn't work well. So this is the paragraph that we came up with that worked much better with people. The important thing is you gave them a relevant reason for the process as to why you were asking this question. A lot of the issues with LGBTs would be that the population does not know that they're disproportionately impacted by tobacco, so they don't think it has anything to do with cessation. And you've got to kind of educate them in the process that this is a community that actually is disproportionately impacted. In a study out of California, 7 out of 10 LGBT men and 4 out of 5 LGBT women thought that they did not smoke more than other people as a population. In another study, only less than one-fifth of our community leaders even thought it was a top health issue. So there's a huge education gap between our own community understanding that they're impacted and the fact that they are so impacted, and which makes it more important to explain to them why would this be related in a quitline situation to cessation. This is another option, two questions, and the top one was tested by National Center for Health Statistics with Ford Foundation and a few others. And so that's a sexual orientation only question, one of the more common ones you see around the country. We do see, though, that that word heterosexual does confuse people, so I would certainly recommend now to take it off. People understand the word straight. And then the sex and gender question below, is this is a way to put gender onto a sex question, but it was only actually tested with youth, and I would say that that's probably an important difference because adults and older generations are probably not as likely to understand some of that phrasing and language there. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in knowing more, to look at our online guide. We've got a bunch of things there at lgbttobacco.org, including the briefing paper here. More copies if you need it. We have state best practices guidelines if you're working with states around what to do to start helping serve your LGBTs more successfully. And I think, I didn't put the poster. We also have Quitline posters and different things like that that are available at the National Network website. So that is it, and I hope that you're newly fired up to go back and make sure you don't make LGBT people invisible every time you think about asking data questions on who you're serving or who you need to serve. Thank you.